You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, former Natural Resource Board Chair Fred Prehn finally resigned at the end of December, more than a year after his term technically ended. We'll talk about the departure as well as the arrival of Governor Evers' appointee to be the new secretary of the DNR. Now, password management services are supposed to make accessing online accounts safe and easy. They let users store info like website logins and passwords, keeping them secure but accessible from anywhere. 3 days before Christmas, LastPass, one of the largest of those password management services, announced that hackers had potentially stolen data from all their users. The CEO of LastPass says the most sensitive info, the passwords, for example, were encrypted when stolen, giving an extra layer of protection against cyber thieves. But our next guest recommends all LastPass users act now to stay safe. What can you do to secure your online accounts? How protected are the passwords that can give anyone access to those accounts? Ketron Evans is the principal cybersecurity advisor at the InfoSec Institute. They have offices in Madison. They're part of the education technology company Cengage Learning Group. Ketron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with what's probably a burning question on the minds of any LastPass user. What should I do now that I've heard about this hack?
Yeah, well, you should definitely change all your credentials, your LastPass login, password, reset and redo your two-factor authentication. But more importantly, or perhaps just as importantly, is you should make sure that you change all the passwords of the accounts that you are protecting with LastPass. I think some people forget the fact that LastPass or password vaults are a location that you store your credentials, username, and password to other locations, so where you can have single sign-on or you don't have to remember a bunch of different passwords. So I think it's important to understand that that vault was compromised. So it's not just your LastPass password, but all the accounts that you're protecting and using with LastPass, those passwords need to be changed as well.
And the biggest worry, maybe that magazine subscription isn't such a big deal, but that bank account or that credit card login, those are the kind of things that could really do damage, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one thing that people forget, too, is with LastPass and other vaults like this, one of the nice features is as you're browsing the internet and setting up new accounts, the plugins that you have in your browser will say, do you want to add this account to LastPass as well? So there may be accounts in there that you've forgotten about that has your password in it as well. So you definitely want to just check in there and make sure you look at and go and change all the credentials that you have in LastPass.
Now, people might be thinking, wait a minute, I do something like LastPass or other password management system to be safer. If they're vulnerable to hacks, should I do them in the first place? What do you tell people?
Well, what I tell people is, number one, any organization is susceptible to being compromised or hacked. I've watched over the last 20 years where an organization gets hacked and then a competitor says, ha, 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 look at these guys getting hacked. And then, a year later, that organization gets hacked. So we have to be realistic here and understand that any organization is susceptible. We've had really high secure government agencies. We've had some of the top cybersecurity firms in the world to be compromised as well just in the last couple of years. So anyone is susceptible. And I don't think you should really make your decision based on a company having a data breach. It's just a matter of how well they handle it and how they responded to it. So I would say don't necessarily jump ship, just tidy up how you manage these things and get into the habit of changing your passwords on a regular basis anyways.
Now, when I log into a lot of accounts that use passwords on browsers, the Chromes, Firefoxes, Explorers, Safaris, you name it, they'll offer me the opportunity to save it or to remember it on that browser for the next time I come back. Should I or shouldn't I?
Well, I think that question depends on your susceptibility to forgetting it and writing it down, because what we've learned over the years is when users aren't given the opportunity to do things like that, they tend to either A, pick very weak passwords and use the same one everywhere because they know they won't forget it, or they do things like write them down or store them in a Word document. And we, over the years, the data tells us that that's actually worse, than allowing your browser to save your passwords and things like that. So just from a pure operation standpoint, and to some extent, just minimizing the amount of security incidents the average end user may have, it's probably okay to have have those passwords remembered.
So writing them down is bad. I get that. What if we want to step up and use that two-factor authentication? People may run into that phrase and not know what it is. What is it? How do we do it? When should we use it?
Sure, absolutely. My answer to that is you should use two-factor authentication everywhere you can use it. You know, if you can use it when you log into your bank account, you should be using two-factor. And essentially what two-factor is when we look at authentication, which is what a password is, there are several different factors. One is something you know, which would be your password. Another factor would be something you have, which could be your cell phone or a security token or something along those lines. And then a third factor might be something you are, which would be your fingerprint, your iris scan, you know, something like that. So we recommend with two-factor using is something you know, which would be your password, and generally something you have, such as your cell phone. And what happens is when you log in and put your password in, now that authentication system will send you a text message or send you a message to an app on your phone that you have to then open and confirm that it's you logging in. So therefore, a hacker grabbing or compromising just your password is not enough for them to authenticate to your account.
What's your advice for coming up with good passwords in the first place?
So I have a couple of things like that. For one, you want to try to use phrases. You know, today I'm talking on Wisconsin Public Radio to share password information. You know, you could use an entire phrase like that and do some substitutions, such as changing A's to at symbols, to where you have a very long phrase that has letters, numbers, and characters. So that's one thing. But another thing is also just taking a phrase, you know, today Keetron's wearing a red shirt, and just take the first letter out of each word in that phrase and make that your authentication string. Therefore, you're not actually using a word, because one of the problems here is the naming. You know, we call it password, so the average user thinks you have to use an actual word, which is the last thing you should be doing, because words are easier to crack. So getting people into the habit of saying passphrase or password string and understanding that your password doesn't have to be an actual word can help to increase the security of that quite a bit from just a pure mathematical cracking standpoint.
Keetron, we'll leave it there. Thanks for the advice today.
Absolutely.
Keetron Evans is the principal cybersecurity advisor for the InfoSec Institute. He joins today with advice on protecting our online passwords after the recently announced hack of the password management service LastPass. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Trolls are everywhere you look in the Dane County village of Mount Horeb. Troll cartoons on the street signs, troll footprints on the sidewalk, sculptures of trolls lining Main Street. The sheer number of trolls in the community prompted a Wisconsin listener to ask, what's the deal with all the trolls? WPR's Tim Peterson went to find the answer.
Over the years, Leah Jaber has frequented a Mount Horeb tea shop with her family. During each visit, the trolls always got the attention of the Madison East High School senior. You know, trolls, those ugly and dim-witted yet powerful ancient figures from Norway's pagan past. To satisfy her curiosity, Jaber reached out to WPR's Wisconsin.
The biggest thing that got me curious is basically just seeing all the trolls but having no idea where they came from or what they represent or what they mean.
I invited Jaber to join me to find the answer in Mount Horeb, officially trademarked the troll capital of the world. We meet at the Mount Horeb Area Historical Society, where Destiny Udelhoven is the director. She says they get asked about the trolls constantly.
What's the deal with the trolls? That's like exactly how they ask it.
Udelhoven says the abundance of trolls harkens back to the area's Norwegian heritage and a marketing push to attract visitors.
I think that's what I want people to see as a historian, is that the trolls didn't spring out of nowhere. We didn't pick them because they were just the most marketable thing. You know, they really have a strong, deep connection to our history here.
That connection being two major waves of Norwegian immigrants to the Mount Horeb area in the mid and late 19th century. Mount Horeb is known for its lasting Norwegian culture, a living museum outside of town with Norwegian-style buildings, annual Norwegian musical performances, and a water tower covered in rosemaling, a stylized Norwegian floral painting. In the 80s, a Mount Horeb resident was also crafting two-dimensional birch bark trolls. Jaber saw these up close at the Historical Society.
So you can walk down this little crevice and you can be surrounded by the trollness of them. Go ahead, you're the one who asked. Yes. Go down there, experience it.
They're definitely different than the carved trolls because they're painted kind of realistically. So yeah, I guess I'm a tiny bit scared, but I think it's It's kind of like joyous energy, I guess.
The carved trolls, the ones you may have seen lining Main Street, the chicken thief, the mayor, local artist Mike Feeney did most of them.
I kind of get a kick out of them because they're humorous. They're a little bit off-center. Trolls really are not like the kind of cuddly things that you want to bring home. The Norwegian trolls are mean and nasty. They'll poison your well. They'll burn your crops. But the Mount Horeb ones are more like the New World trolls, a little happier, a little more jovial, and a little bit off-kilter.
Feeney was commissioned by the village in the 1980s to solve a marketing problem. That's according to Jim Leary, professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's also a longtime resident of Mount Horeb.
In the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit.
Not everyone in the village loved the trolls right away, and Feeney says some came around when they started getting results.
They kind of fought for their existence, the trolls did, and then the people behind them really enjoyed them, and then apparently they brought a lot of people coming to town, taking their picture in front of the troll.
And while the trolls aren't for everyone, many locals will tell you they're lucky. And in this village, trolls are the protectors of the residents, the businesses, and nature.
WPR's Tim Peterson brought us that story on Mount Horeb's trolls. And that story idea came to us from an audience question as part of WPR's Wisconsin. Submit your question and we might answer it. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a holdover leaves the Natural Resources Board long after his term expired as Governor Evers appoints a new head of the DNR. We'll check out the latest news in natural resources here in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're catching up now on some developments over the past few weeks that could have impacts on environmental policy here in Wisconsin. In the last week of 2022, Governor Evers appointed Adam Payne to replace Preston Cole as Secretary of the Department of Natural Resources. A few days later, Fred Prain resigned from the Natural Resources Board, which sets policy for the DNR. We've talked about Prain on the show. He was a Scott Walker appointee. He refused to leave the board for more than a year after his term technically ended, after the state Senate took no action on his appointed replacement. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin. She's been following both of these stories. Danny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Let's start with this Fred Prain saga. A lot of twists and turns here. Can you talk about, first of all, why he was still on the board well after his term of appointment had ended?
Yeah, well, he was still on the board because he just refused to step down after the end of his 6-year term, which expired at the in May of 2021. He had been there and appointed, as you said, by Governor Scott Walker. But he said that he was not going to step down and that he believed that there were some issues related to PFAS and nitrates and wolf management that could use his leadership on the board. And so he remained in his seat, really sparking a controversy that has lasted until he exited the board just last week or at the end of December.
And Governor Evers had appointed a replacement to take his spot at the end of the term. The state Senate didn't confirm that replacement. And so Prain argued, well, there's nobody here, so I have to stay on the job. And the state Supreme Court ultimately agreed with them, right?
Yeah, the state Supreme Court did rule that nobody has to remove themselves from that position, that he could have held over in his seat, and that a vacancy is only created when a person dies or resigns or is removed for cause. But as we've seen throughout history, there's a lot of precedent for board members to make way for the incoming appointee or nominee. And that has happened it's largely been the case. There's only been at least two cases that I can recall since the early 2000s where board members have refused to step down from their post. And that's happened under both political parties, both Republicans and Democrats. And so usually it's a little bit more civil as far as the political actions on this board. You know, it's the board that sets policy for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. But with the Republican-controlled legislature and a Democrat leading our state from the governor's office, this has been a bit more politically tumultuous than we have seen in years past.
And adding to the controversy, there were some communications between Prehn and Republican leaders about his decision to stick around. In one case saying, in effect, until a Republican governor wins the 2022 election. What do we know about those communications?
Yeah, and those communications came as the result of a separate case, an open records case against Fred Prehn to try and get more information or background about why he decided to stay on the board, right? And so this was a case that was brought by Midwest Environmental Advocates, and text messages from his phone and other devices showed that he sought to maintain conservative control of the Natural Resources Board. And this has been widely reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that Prehn sought advice from conservative lobbyists and state senators, former Governor Scott Walker, and former Republican candidate for governor Rebecca Clayfish. Like you alluded to, he even wrote a text to one individual saying, "I'll see if I can hang on until Becky gets in." So clearly there were some political motivations here for why he decided to remain on the board.
And now the saga ends. Fred Prehn is stepping down from the board. Did he give an indication of why now?
When he issued his letter of resignation, he said it was time for state legislators to act on Governor Evers' nomination and that it was time for him to move on. He did take an opportunity to get in some final digs at the Evers administration, saying that, you know, there have been repeated actions where he felt the administration has ignored statutes or policies that have been developed over the years, and that the administration has gone rogue as far as many of its decisions to regulate natural resources across the state. Yeah, I think it's just like a difference of opinion of what we're seeing here in Wisconsin. You know, he obviously has his own idea of how natural resources should be managed in Wisconsin, and that is quite different than how Democratic Governor Tony Evers and his appointees see that natural resources should be overseen here in our state.
Talking to Danielle Kading, WPR reporter, about some big stories at the DNR, the Natural Resources Board. Well, Danny, you just mentioned the governor's appointees just made a big one. Preston Cole stepped down at the end of the current of the governor's first term in office. And now we have a new DNR secretary designee anyway. What do we know about Adam Prehn?
Yeah, so Governor Evers appointed Adam Prehn just in the last week of December, after you mentioned that Secretary Preston Cole announced he was retiring and stepped down in November. And Prehn has been serving as the Sheboygan County Administrator for the past two decades, and he's overseen development of the county budgets there, as well as program policy changes, including guiding the county through the cleanup of the Sheboygan River and Harbor. And he's also overseen a project to preserve more than 300 acres of undeveloped Lake Michigan shoreline at Amsterdam Dunes. And he also has a background leading the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association as its executive director. So he's got a background in conservation and also as an administrator. And so he'll be stepping into that role at a time when there are some big issues that are coming up for the board.
And I wanted to ask you about that. A new DNR secretary, a change in the DNR board. You're reporting on these issues. What is on your mind? What are you watching for in 2023?
Well, one of the key ones has been PFAS, these harmful forever chemicals that don't break down easily in the environment and can lead to harmful health effects like kidney and testicular cancers, thyroid disease, and other issues like fertility. And so what we've seen so far is that the state has actually taken steps to enact drinking water and surface water standards for those chemicals, but it failed to enact groundwater standards for PFAS in the state. And it recently, the board recently launched the process of crafting regulations for four PFAS chemicals moving forward. And so the board will oversee whatever happens with that. And there are going to be some terms or positions opening up when several board members, their terms are expiring this year. And so it'll be interesting to see if they decide to remain in their seats or if they'll be stepping down to make way for any new appointees.
Danny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, covering the environment, energy, and northern Wisconsin. She talked with us today about two big stories on natural resources here in the state. By the way, next Monday at 4:15, the new DNR Secretary appointee Adam Payne will join us here on Central Time. If there's something you want us to ask the new Secretary of the DNR, an issue that's important to you when it comes to natural resources in the state, send us a note right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we can do a lot of things online. That doesn't mean we necessarily should. According to the author of the new book, The Future is Analog, How to Create a More Human World. And we'll take a tour of children's museums around the state and some new exhibits for 2023. And you can share your favorite children's museum or other children's activity in your community. Again, you can get us started right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we talk to an economist about recent increases to the minimum wage in many states around the U.S., but not here in Wisconsin, and the impact it can all have on workers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, President Biden visited the U.S.-Mexico border this weekend after announcing immigration policy changes. We'll learn more about the new directives and what impact they could have. First, to kick off the new year, 23 states and Washington, D.C. increased their minimum wages. In some cases, that was because of new laws on the books. In others, it was because of cost of living adjustments included in existing laws. Wisconsin was not one of those states. That leaves the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour for adults who are considered non-tipped employees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the minimum wage in Wisconsin should go up? Why or why not? If you're an employer, how would an increased minimum wage affect you, if at all? If you work or have worked at minimum wage, how much would an increase help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison. He worked as the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be with you.
Can you paint for us a picture of how minimum wage works in the country? We have this U.S. law, and then states do their own thing.
Yes. Minimum wages are set at the federal level, but then states are free to do as they see fit. And we haven't had an increase in the federal minimum wage, although most states, 30 or 31 of them, have increased their own minimum wages. Within some states, certain areas or cities have higher minimum wages too. Now, Wisconsin doesn't allow sub-state minimums. In other words, you can't pay people more, you can't have a higher minimum wage, let's say in Madison or Milwaukee, than in Bayfield. And we haven't increased our minimum wage since the feds increased theirs. So we're a little bit behind here. The interesting thing this year, one of the most interesting things is what you mentioned, the inflation adjustments. 15 states have substantially higher minimum wages because they took into account the inflation that workers and families felt last year. So that's kind of new and that's kind of big. And you know, even with we have a strong labor market, and that makes a difference in most places. But even then, the minimum wage is going to have a strong effect on 8 or 9 million workers. Even if people living in cities say, oh, well, you know, no one works for that wage anymore. Well, people do work for that wage anymore in some places. And increasing the minimum wage is a signal to potential workers that they're going to be able to earn more than they maybe thought they could, or that their wages won't fall below a certain level if they go to work. So I still think it's a worthwhile thing to do. And if people say, well, we're already paying more than that, then fine, why not do it?
Now, you in the past on our network have talked about, you know, what might be a reasonable minimum wage for Wisconsin. A lot of people who are advocating for increases are looking at a $15 mark. You say that might, at least as of a year ago or so, you said that might not be the right target for Wisconsin. What would you see as, you know, possible steps in increasing the minimum wage here in Wisconsin?
That's exactly right, Rob. I think $15 across the board is not wise in Wisconsin. If it turns out to be 15 because of market pressures in Madison or Milwaukee or other high cost areas, fine. But I think we should look at something like $10 or $11. I mean, we have to look at Illinois, it's got $13. And Minnesota's at $10.60 plus more for larger employers. In fact, in the labor market is so strong in Minnesota that the average wage of their 10th percentile workers, in other words, the 10th worker from the bottom, is already $14 an hour. So increasing the minimum wage because of inflation in Illinois is going to affect maybe 4% of the workers. Increasing it to $13 in Illinois, I'm sorry, is going to affect 9%. Increasing it to $10.60 is going to affect 4% of the workers in Minnesota. So workers are affected. And if you're living on the border of either of those states, gee, $7.50 on this side, $13, $14 on that side, are you going to cross a bridge or a state line to go to work? I would think so. So it's even harder to hire workers at the minimum wage in Wisconsin if you're living near the border of the states that are paying much more.
Let's talk about minimum wage as a policy tool. What was the goal? What is the goal of establishing minimum wages and possibly increasing them from time to time?
Well, the goal is to make sure that people are paid at least some minimum that they're worth. And people won't work at really low wages because it costs money to go to work and to get childcare and everything like that. But if you raise the wages, they're more willing to go to work. They're willing to work different hours and so on. So, and we all know that in most labor markets today, demand exceeds supply. There are some openings, but still, workers need the assurance that they're going to get paid at least the minimum amount. And that hasn't really reduced employment as far as we know in almost all cases we've looked at in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years. So it doesn't discourage work. It sends a message that workers are important. And in a minute, if you want, we could also talk about a separate wage called the tippable minimum wage, which affects workers in the hospitality and restaurant industries. And in Wisconsin, it's $2.33 an hour, which is among the lowest in all the states. $2.33 an hour. A tippable wage in Illinois is $7.80 an hour. So that means it's the minimum you get even before you got tips. So if it's a really slow day or a bad day, you're going to at least get $7.80 an hour, plus some tips. So there are a number of different aspects to this that we could deal with.
Talking to Tim Smeeting from UW-Madison, professor of public affairs and economics there. Looking at minimum wage laws in Wisconsin, at the national level and in states around the country. Wisconsin, one of the states still at the federal level of $7.25 an hour for non-tipped workers. While many states just this last few days have seen an increase in their minimum wage. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about minimum wage laws and what do you want to see happen? Do you like them where they are in Wisconsin? Do you want to see them increased? If you live in one of our neighboring states, are they higher minimum wage? What do you think about that? And hey, how about that separate tipped wage? Have you worked for that? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, some people who talk about that, sometimes that $15 mark or talk about a living wage, talk about, okay, how much money would it take? What's the minimum wage it would take to keep someone, you know, out of poverty or have a livable wage? How do we calculate that sort of thing?
Well, that's a really interesting question. First of all, you should know that most minimum wages workers are over age 25, so it's not teenagers, and most of them are full-time workers as well. So the problem with the living wage is how many people are trying to live off that wage? $15 an hour, full-year full-time, that's $30,000 a year, will keep a family of three out of poverty according to the supplemental poverty measure, okay? And if you've only got, if you've got two workers, though, that would be, you'd make $60,000 a year, you'd be far above poverty. If you're trying to support a family of four or five on one $15 an hour job, you don't have enough. So that's part of the problem, because the minimum wages aren't family size adjusted and the living wage isn't either. So I always tell people the living wage, how many people have to live at this wage? How many people work in this household and how many hours? And then I can tell you whether it's adequate or not in terms of comparing it to a poverty measure.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dean is with us in Cudahy. Dean, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I don't think you can live on anything less than $18 an hour. Apartment prices are up. If you expect children or young adults to move out of their parents' house, you cannot afford gas. You cannot afford insurance. You cannot afford food. You cannot afford anything of any kind of luxury or car payment on $10 an hour in Wisconsin. It's ridiculous. No way.
Dean, thanks for the call. And Tim, Dean doing something a little more complicated there, comparing the minimum wage to the cost of living.
No, he's no. Being out of poverty doesn't mean living comfortably. Mm-hmm. In fact, a wage that allows you to live comfortably, according to the Alice people who calculate budgets and things, would have to be a wage of around $20 or $25 an hour. And again, I'm with Dean. $18 an hour for one worker is not enough. But if one worker is working full-time at $15 and another one's working half-time at $15, you'll be above $18. But two workers also means you need more money for childcare, you need more money for transportation and everything. So I understand what Dean's saying, to live decently, to be able to afford a car, afford a house, to have a little bit of savings in case things go off the tracks. You need more than the minimum wage. It's just a starting point. And even more so, you need jobs that give you some sort of employment growth or a chance to move forward so that if you start at wage X, you can move up the wage Y, given good performance over a period of time. I mean, employers are wise in this now. Employers aren't doing exit interviews for people who are quitting. They're interviewing the workers they've got right now and saying, are you happy? How's things going? You know, I hope, you know, we're paying you what we can. Is there anything else we can do for you? And so forth, because you want to hold on to workers. It is very expensive to have big worker turnover. So right now, workers are in a really good position because the demand for jobs far exceeds the supply of workers. And you have more choice and probably can do much better now than you could have 3 or 4 years ago.
Dean, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Tim Smeeting, Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, looking at the minimum wage. Almost half U.S. states saw an increase this year. Wisconsin still at the federal baseline minimum wage. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. What do you think the minimum wage should be increased to in Wisconsin, or should it hold steady as it is? Should different communities be able to have different minimum wage levels, maybe depending on their local cost of living? They can't do that right now under state law. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tim Smeeting, Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, with us to talk about an increase in minimum wages after 23 states, not including Wisconsin, raised their state minimum wage at the beginning of the year. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see minimum wage look like in Wisconsin? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Minocqua. Dennis, hi.
Hey, Rob. How are you this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Good. Real quick, I'm just curious to ask your guest, Tim. He indicated that there were literally thousands and thousands of people who are working under the minimum wage of $7.25, $7.50, whatever it is in Wisconsin. But in reality, there's hardly a store that you can enter that isn't offering on their doorstep $14, $15, $16 an hour, including, of course, totally unskilled labor, McDonald's, Quick Trip, blah, blah, blah. So I guess I'm wondering why people that are working currently up to $7.25, $50 minimum aren't simply picking up and heading over because the market is allowing a payment of $14 to $16 an hour. Why would they stay at a $7.50 an hour job? Thank you for your time, Rob.
Dennis, I'm with you. They're not staying in those jobs. They're moving. I mean, tippable wages are an issue in the restaurant industry, and it's hard. How many places, I know for a fact, in Madison, most places are only open four days a week, and only for dinner, and then only for limited hours, a lot of them, simply because they can't afford and find enough labor to work there and enough other employees like cooks and others. So the market does make a big effect. But people with tippable minimum wages of $2.33 an hour, some employers try and say, oh, the kitchen staff is part of the tippable, even though they're not serving food. The guys who are washing the dishes, they're part of the tippable group too. So they get $2.33 an hour. Plus tips, and you share some tips, but tip sharing is supposed to come up to $7.25 an hour on average. But if it doesn't, it doesn't. So, I see those same signs that you see. I don't know how many women want to work the swing shift or the midnight shift at Quick Trip where you can make $16 an hour. But sometimes the people who come in may not be the kindest people. And I know that in industries that are paying those higher wages, they're monitoring productivity and performance. There's, maybe this way it should be, but I'm just saying it's a fact that employers are looking at productivity and output and ability to get the jobs done and so forth. Look at supermarkets. How many times have you been to a supermarket lately where there are two or three lines that actually have tellers in them? And those lines are on the block, and mainly what you do is you go check your own groceries out by going to a machine. That's the way that employers adjust for higher wages. And all of these probably making more than minimum wage. So I just think that if you want to compete with other states and that raising that minimum wage isn't going to hurt, it's probably going to help you. It's going to send a signal to people who aren't working that maybe – working conditions and wages are better than you thought. Maybe you ought to look again at a job. So I'm not arguing with you, Dennis. And from where I sit, I don't know how it is in Minocqua, but from where I sit, I see those same signs and they're good. Of course, rents are high. They may not include health insurance, which is really expensive. Childcare costs are high. In fact, that's a two-sided edge. So those care workers don't make a lot of money. But the more they make, the more that the employer has to charge you to use childcare or elder care. So and the more you need to make, therefore, to afford it. So it's a two-sided sword there, too.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And Tim, I mean, this last year and a half or so, this is kind of a weird time for the labor market, right? I can't remember a comparable period in my lifespan, as long as it may be.
It's weird, but it's not going away. There's, if you look, there was a report last week from Brookings of, let's say, look at our state of Wisconsin. The only way we gained population was through immigration. People who were, who moved in here. The deaths exceeded births in our state. We were very close to the same. So if you don't have population growth, and even if you have young babies, it takes a while for them to grow up and be workers, you know, you end up with unemployment rates that are 2 and 3% with very few workers on the sidelines. There are a few, but not a lot. Some of them for health-related reasons. So this is not going away. This is not a one-time sort of thing. And what employers are looking at, of course, is robotics and other technological aids. So they need fewer workers. Look at farms and automatic milking machines and all sorts of other, you know, seed, you know, things that work on crops that, you know, lay seeds down and cultivate and whatever. They're run by robots. That's because workers are really expensive and machinery might be able to provide an equally productive output for a lower cost.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom joins us now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest, to my knowledge, the country of Sweden eliminated their minimum wage, and yet people there seem to have competitive living wages. Does he know how that happens?
Tom, thanks. Sure. Go ahead, Tim. Yeah.
Sure. They pay you those wages. They have wage setting and wage bargaining. They do have some minimum wages. They don't want to take advantage of immigrants. Most of their immigrants are refugees and asylum seekers. But and they also, you know, their health care, it's, quote, free, unquote. It's covered through a value-added tax. It's not charged to the employer. And they have good social retirement, too. And they have highly subsidized child care. So all of those things, you know, make it easier to work at a little bit lower wages, but their wages are generally fairly high at the bottom. In most of the Europe, you're not all in unions, quote unquote, but there's central wage bargaining and central wage setting. So if you're paying one group of employees X, that spreads to other similar groups of employees. So, I mean, they've for a long time, they've had better working conditions and higher wages and more equal wages. Some of the countries have laws like in Germany that the CEO of a company can't make more than some multiple of what the lowest paid worker makes. But those labor markets are much more managed than ours. Work conditions are much better enforced and so forth and so on. And the interesting issue for us is going to be we have about 2 million people in this country who are either have somehow been admitted or are looking for work. Many of them are asylum seekers. Others are, some of them may be, you know, undocumented and whatever. Those people come here to work and they want to work. So how much should we pay them? Should we pay them less because they happen to be from Nicaragua or Mexico or Afghanistan or Cuba than we pay others? That's a really important question. And if we have a minimum wage and we enforce it, then they'll get paid something worth their while for working too.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Hey, thanks, Rob. This was more interesting than the last few times we've discussed this. The labor market's hot. Inflation's up. The minimum wage seems to be helping, still be helping people in a lot of places, except for us, except for Wisconsin.
That's Tim Smeeting, the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about minimum wage increases in many states around the U.S. and the impact of increasing wages. Not Wisconsin, as Tim just mentioned, not among those states raising the minimum wage this year. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a foreign policy and immigration expert about the Biden administration's new policy that would turn away certain migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border, offer some possible ways in for people from selected countries, and the president's visit to the border over the weekend. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We'll be right back.